Tony Simpson, Ryan Champion and Jack Bennion.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally, episode 6, season 11, back in full strength. Are you going to see Britney Spears in Scarborough or Blackpool? If you are, drop us a tweet, let us know, because we want to know what Britney Spears was like. I never ever thought I'd start an Absolute Rally podcast like that. Anyway, on my right, I say, welcome back, DJ Ryan Champion. Hello, Ryan Champion.
Hello, no, I didn't think you'd start like that, even given the previous conversation we just had.
No, you know what? I don't know why I even started with it. In a normal circumstance, I'd say, you know what, let's start again. But I'm not, because I want to leave people wondering why we were talking about Britney Spears. And on my left, I'll say hello, Jack Bennion.
Hello, I'm glad to be back in this toxic atmosphere.
The toxic No, I can't believe we're doing Britney Spears. Just hit me one more time with that, Jack.
Oh,
there you go.
Gets
now
worse.
Now we've started. Ryan, don't you dare.
Move on, boys,
we're all back together. This just seems weird. It feels like we haven't all been together for like forever. Ryan's obviously been a DJ. How is your DJing career going, Ryan Champion?
I don't actually remember doing any DJing, but I was in Ibiza for a while, yeah. And now in snowy Sweden with a lot of snow.
With a lot of snow. Well, we've had a little bit of snow over here, but we decided that we were going to call you DJ Ryan Champion, but no one kind of picked up on it, unfortunately. We didn't really run with it. It was Jack Bennion's idea. I blame him. Jack, it is nice, all three of us, to be back. It's Rally Mexico coming up. I want to talk about Rally Mexico a little bit further down the line, because we've been threatening to talk about this, and it has been gathering pace, of course, with regards to Safari Rally. And you flippantly and jokingly said, quite rightly, if only we had somebody that knew a little bit about the event. Oh, where's Ryan Champion when you need him? And now he's back. So I think we should probably get Ryan Champion's take on this. What do you reckon, Jack?
That's the next 40 minutes of the podcast sorted. I can just switch off now.
You can now, yeah. We'll just log off. Yeah, just leave Ryan. Press play and just retire a safe distance. Ryan Champion, we very briefly spoke about it off air, but we just thought it'd be quite good to get your take on the realities of what is seems to be gathering some pace.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be. Obviously, Jean Todt's been out there and met with government representatives. The Kenyan government are actually, you know, really, really behind the idea, supportive of the idea. I believe they've put somewhere in the region of $2 million behind the project. So, you know, they're very keen for it to happen. Having said that, I guess there's a long way between a will to see it happen and an actual reality of it happening. I think, as we've touched on before, one of the key things for WRC's return to Africa and to Kenya for the Safari Rally will be having closed stages. And that's something that we've never seen in Africa. We don't see with the classic safari, for example, but it does happen on some local events there. That'll mean holding it on private property in, some private park somewhere. So that'll be key, I think, is ensuring that the stages are close to the public, close to traffic, because that's always been something that Safari was part of Safari, but obviously something that wouldn't fit in WRC now.
Jack, I know what I want to ask. Right, I'm going to let you go first, though.
I'm not really anything specific to ask. I just add to what Ryan's saying in terms of the closed roads. It's almost a shame in a way, because it's something that every closed road rally struggles with, is making sure people aren't driving down the route in the wrong direction and things like that. It's quite difficult to control where people are and stuff on a route, but there's going to be so much kind of attention spent on the safari that any small kind of error that they make is going to be blown out into a massive deal, isn't it? So hopefully they get everything right first time if it does come about. And I think it is worth pointing out that it is something that all closed road rallies are a problem that they all face.
Right, there's a couple of things that when I first seen the story, I'm quite cynical when I see stuff like that these days. Maybe it's age and everything else. I was thinking, okay, there's a lot going on. There was a lot of, with regards to votes and things like that for Jean Todt. I think he's probably moved on from that. In fact, Martin Holmes talks a little bit later on the podcast about that. And then I started thinking more about what the teams went through back in the day with Group A cars. You think about what Toyota did. And, you know, basically had Ian Duncan out there just pretty much all year getting ready for the safari. And then I start to think of, you know, things have moved on. Of course, technology's moved on. You know, I'm stating the obvious here, but are these cars, are these strong enough? It just seems, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this point, but to me, they look too fragile for a safari.
It will be obviously a key point, and it'll be something that's discussed, because obviously what we see in WRC now is an out and out sprint. There are no rallies where either the cars or the drivers pace themselves. You know, it is absolutely 100% all the time. And in the past, when Safari was around at the championship, then, you know, it was a different attitude really towards the rallies, and particularly Safari. It was one that you had to get around. Now, even in period, obviously, I think when Mitsubishi went there with Tommy Mäkinen, they took a slightly different attitude to it. Mäkinen attacked the rally a little bit harder, and then they changed a lot of parts. But as you've just alluded to, I mean, Toyota used to spend 6 months out there. They used to have a base in Nairobi, and they were developing a car constantly, really, for Safari. And again, I'm sure that's something that if Safari is going to be included in WRC, the teams will be very, very keen to make sure that the cars don't need a total re-engineering, or else it'll just add massively to the cost. Now, the historic route of Safari, and even the roads that we use on the Safari Classic, can be very, very rough. But funnily enough, I was speaking to Jonathan Sorman today, who has done the Safari Classic, a Kenyan who drives an Escort out there, and he was saying there are some smooth stages, you know, they can be found further north in Kenya. And I think if we see a rally coming back, it will be a much shorter, more compact route than what there's been. So hopefully they could find some smoother stages, then the cars wouldn't need totally re-engineering, but it still needs to be a safari, doesn't it? If it's just a gravel rally in Africa, then that wouldn't recapture the magic of the Safari rally. So it needs to be a balance. There still needs to be a test involved in going to Africa and doing a rally.
Right. Before I bring Jack back in, my concern with something like this now, and obviously you've been there several times, so, you know, by all means put me straight. There's a level of naivety probably in what I'm just about to say, but with regards to infrastructure, you know, motor clubs and things like that, you know, marshals and all these other things for a WRC event, I don't know where they're going to generate that from. Are they going to have to ship people in? You know, how's it going to work?
Well, that will certainly be one of the challenges. I mean, you've got Surinder Tati, who's actually a good friend of Jean Todt's, who actually works with the FIA as an FIA steward. He's been heavily involved in African rallying before and latterly with the Safari Classic. Now, I guess if somebody like Surinder's involved, he would certainly have the know-how to pull a team together. But, you know, it's very, very different putting on an event in Africa and putting on a WRC round. So I think I'm sure the FIA will want to see a candidate rally, and I think if they're trying to aim for, say, 2020 with WRC, that would mean next year as a candidate rally, and that would be very difficult in a very short timescale to find venues, to pull an organising team together and to make it happen. But I guess if the government are backing it, if there's finance there to make sure that's in place, then they can pull people in. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the key to a successful rally will be having very slick organisation, making sure that there isn't any issues, and running a very effective rally. But it will be tough to build a team from scratch to run a WRC rally in this modern era.
Couldn't agree more. Jack Bengen, have you got anything you want to add to that before we move on to your place of work?
I think it'd be stupid of me to even enter the conversation of the majesty that is Ryan Champion when it comes to Safari rallying.
That's a strong point. I'll be honest with you. I was on my knees as I was talking to him during that particular piece.
Oh, please.
Don't, Jack. Don't. Right. We're going to come to MN this week.
Point out I'm in a different country at this point.
I wish I was in a different country.
People have found that hard to swallow. Front page of MN this week, Jack Bengen. We've got Rally back on the front of it. Of course, Rally Mexico is coming up. And it's Elfin being quite hard on himself at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, he's described his start to the season as rubbish, which is, that is pretty harsh on himself, isn't it? But we know Elfin well, fairly well, I think, at this point, and he is relatively hard on himself when it comes to his performances, and he's not been happy with the start of his season. But you know, this is the first proper gravel rally. You'd say this is a place that Elfin likes to go. He enjoys Mexico and enjoys the stages, so this is his chance to kind of put the wrongs of Monty and Sweden behind him. He had punctures on both of those events fairly early on, and that kind of messed with his rhythm. I think the times towards the Monty we spoke about quite a lot at the time, didn't we, that if you took the puncture out of the equation, he'd have been, you know, roughly a minute behind Ogier in the end. So I think fairly strong performance in the Monty after the puncture, and then Sweden didn't quite go his way, similar problems with the puncture. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how he gets on, and like I said, it'll be a rally that he enjoys, I think.
Right, we've not really spoke, obviously, I think probably since Sweden. Obviously, you normally keep your finger on the pulse of things. You know, Jack's just been talking about what Elfin went through there. Surely, you know, the points obviously are on the board now, and you can't really dispute that. But it's still incredibly early for anybody to be hard on any driver at the moment.
Yeah, it is. But I'm sure Elfin knows this is his big opportunity. It's his chance back in the big time. Number two to arguably the best driver in the world. So he has the best teammate to learn from. And he not only does he want to make the most of it, he needs to make the most of it for his career. So I'm sure he's, you know, very, very keen, be it early in the season or not, to start putting results in there and to prove he can match and beat Sebastian Ogier in the same car. So a big weekend coming up for him. He's got great road position. The car will be good. And, you know, I think that's why he'll be out to make the most of it. And, yeah, it is early, but nonetheless, we know how seasons can just slip away. And it does seem to be, if you have a good start to the season, you build some momentum and you carry that through the year. So he'll be keen to put Sweden behind him and get a great result on the board.
Jack Rice just mentioned road position and things like that there, because Thierry Neuville's going to have that job which Sebastian Ogier's mentioned once or twice, the road sweeping duties this particular weekend. You guys have wrote a piece about that as well.
Yeah, it's I think Dave Evans referred to it as one of the biggest challenges of Thierry Neuville's career, which is strong, but you know, it's difficult to disagree, isn't it? It's going to be a very difficult job to sweep the road. I think it's difficult looking at the results last year. I think a lot of people forget the sort of first day that we had in Mexico last year, where a lot of people were having engine troubles and things like that, which distorted the order quite heavily, I think. But it's going to be interesting to see how the different manufacturers get on with the engines. But Thierry is definitely going to struggle on that first day. There's no doubt about it. And it seems like we've got a lot warmer weather than we had last year, which could also add to the road sweeping conditions. But it's always a lottery with these things, isn't it? We can all sit here and pretend to be experts, but things like Sweden, where a combination of the extra snow and the national rally kind of threw the order on its head on the Friday, didn't it? And I think, you know, it's very difficult to try and predict what the road's going to do, but it's definitely going to be an advantage whatever happens. I think it's just going to be how much of an advantage Thierry's actually at and whether he can recover from it afterwards.
Right, I know 99% of our listenership will probably appreciate what Monsieur Loeb, and they said Loeb then, and Monsieur Ogier is mentioned numerous times, and obviously what Thierry's about to go into. But what is the big deal, you know? And we know obviously Hayden had words with Sebastian Ogier the other year about it. What is the big deal? Why are people talking about road sweeping? Is it because it's just the first gravel rally, or is it that much of a difference?
It's certainly a difference, and you know, we talk about it every year, don't we? And even in Sweden as well, it's not just on the gravel rallies, it happens on the snow rallies as well when you get the fresh snow. But yeah, come this time of year, the start of the gravel season, then we hear it year on year about changing road positions, going back to qualifying. You know, we've heard rumours recently so that the shakedown stage would set or give an option, choice of running order. But it's something that makes a huge difference. The first car on the road is cleaning that surface, and it just gets faster and faster thereafter. It does certainly make a difference running lower down the order. Having said that, the qualifying stage was dropped because it was felt, I mean, it was probably as we know, to penalise Sebastian Ogier at the time for dominating everything. But ultimately, if you're leading the world championship, then you know you're currently running first on the road, and it is, I guess, a little bit of a leveller. But it does mean that the world championship leader is massively at a disadvantage on the first day. Should it be different? I don't know. Like I said, we've seen qualifying before. I guess if you want the fairest system, it's qualifying, but you know, it does shake the championship up. It keeps it tight if the world championship leader runs first on the road. But is it fair that they can't win the rally? Because ultimately, that's probably the situation.
Do you think he's got off a little bit lighter, Thierry, this year? Obviously, the big stage on day one was 50 miles long at one point, 35 miles last year, El Chocolat, that we obviously were talking about. Now it's down to just shy of 20 miles. So, you know, you can imagine doing 50 miles and getting the road sweeping effect doing 50 miles, but obviously broken down into smaller sections. Does it lessen the impact?
Well, it's all about the overall mileage, isn't it? You know, it's whatever the overall mileage is, then that's where the disadvantage is. When you're passing for the second time, obviously, you're still cleaning the road a little bit, even the second time, because it does tend to, with some of the lower runners, obviously, it does tend to drag the gravel in again sometimes. But certainly it's the first pass that counts. So if you've got reduced mileage, that obviously plays into his hands.
I'm going to bring Jack in now, because on that particular piece, Jack, you guys have wrote a little bit about your hero.
I have to add at this point all the time, don't I, that I'm not biased, and I absolutely do not favour any drivers, but Sebastian Loeb's definitely my favourite driver by a mile. he's been, I think, swatting up is the correct term to use, I think, isn't it, with Sebastian. Are we happy to see him back yet? Can I ask you that?
I'm really massively still on the fence.
It's tough, isn't it? Because we spoke to Craig last week, and you know, it's great to see Craig kind of making that breakthrough and pushing himself forwards a little bit, and really looking like he can start to you know, regularly finish in decent positions. But seeing Sebastian come back is just generating so much interest, isn't it? Well, it is for me, because you've got the sort of combined effect of Sebastian being quite far back on the road, which is obviously going to play into his hands on the first day. But, you know, is his rustiness, if you like, going to play into it, or is he going to be smack bang on the pace? It's going to be so interesting to see where he ends that first day. And the last time we saw him on a rally, it was tooth and nail with Ogier until he retired on the Monty. So it's really exciting to kind of think about where Sebastian's going to be at the end of that first day, and there's so many things to be decided, isn't there? It's going to be really exciting first day at Rally Mexico, I think.
I think what Citroën have done, and we talk about this a bit later on the pod as well, but what Citroën have done, and I'm going to put this to you two boys, because I put it to Martin Holmes, and smoke and mirrors gone. We did the piece with Martin before we recorded the top of the podcast. So if Ogier would have went back to Citroën, Jack, would Loeb be doing what he's doing? Nothing about their personal, nothing about their personal differences, what they've had in the past. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a French manufacturer finding a way of getting a French driver in the car to keep people, dare I say, onside.
I think a lot of it would depend on the how the rest of the driver lineup would have played up. So if they had brought in Loeb for this year, and he was full time, say, for the season, you would think that would be Chris and Sebastian, wouldn't it, from the start of the year? So that would mean Craig would be in some sort of recurring third entry. So I don't know, really. I think the answer is yes. I think they still would have tried to get Loeb back in the car. I think it's a great PR stunt for them, and I think he's a 9-time world champion. If you're gonna, you know, you've got an opportunity to get him back in your car, the car's not looking like it's gonna be good enough to win the Manufacturers Championship. Can we say that yet? It's probably a little bit early to say that yet. But getting him back in the car is definitely brilliant PR for Citroën, I think.
Ryan Champion?
Oh, it's great to see him back. There's no two ways about it. Fantastic to see him back in the championship, but I just wish it was in the third car. There's no point in debating whether he should be in the second car or not. But It's good for the championship. It's good for the interest around it. Would he be back in it if Ogier was in the team? Not sure he would. Would Sebastian Loeb really want to put himself back up against Sebastian Ogier in the same car when Ogier was in it regularly? I'm not sure. I think if he gets beat by Chris Meek, which he would realistically expect, then he'll take that easier than he would getting beat by Ogier in the same car, would be my opinion.
Yeah, you know what? I'm so conflicted because I'm a bit like you guys. It's nice to see Loeb back, but I again we spoke about this even I think last year. I suppose the legacy, you know, he was dominant. It's a bit like, you know, you think about, you know, a world heavyweight title, you know, a boxer or something like that, you know, undefeated, and then once they're defeated, you know, a bit of the mystique goes, a bit of the shine goes. You think about, you know, I'm using boxing for, not very often I'll use boxing as a comparison. You think about Mike Tyson, Jack, back in the day when he was unbeatable and he held all, you know, he was an undisputed champion of the world. And then once he got beat, there was a chink in the armor. And I don't think I want to see Loeb get beat, whether he's coming back part time on his own terms or whatever it may be. I love seeing him doing the stuff in the 306 Maxi. I think we all agree. That's amazing. But I'm not sure in a world championship for me is where I want to see him.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think part of me thinks, sort of along the similar lines to what Ryan was saying, he wouldn't have come back if he didn't think he could be at least a little bit competitive. I really don't think that a 9-time world champion would genuinely come back after so long out and really, you know, have a good go at this if he didn't think he was going to be sort of at least in the ballpark in terms of pace. So, you know, I think it's as I said before, I think it's a bit of a masterstroke PR wise for Citroën, but also I think there's no way Sebastian would do this if he didn't think he was at least he's not going to come out and embarrass himself on purpose. You know, there's got to be a belief there that he's going to be on the pace. So I think it's 50-50.
Okay. Listen, moving on. Before we go away from Mexico, boys, did you see the video that went out of the R5 Scala that went up in flames?
I've not seen the video. I've seen pictures of it.
Oh, it was just sickening. I so feel for the guy. I don't know whether it's a rented car or whether it's his own car. I'm trying to think. It was a motorsport Italia car.
Yeah. So it's, you know, professional team, well known for running Skodas, ran Andreas Mikkelsen in the Skoda UK car. So, you know, very professional team. So really, really sad to see.
Yeah. Now, do you know what? There's a little part of me, and I was watching and I'm thinking, I hope he's insured. And then I'm thinking, well, if he's got on stage cover, how does that work in the service park?
No idea.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's such a grey area, isn't it? And I really hope he's covered. I really do, because just to see it go up was just sickening. It really was.
It's a shame because he was third in WRC2 last year in Mexico, and I think I'm pretty sure he was third in Argentina the next round as well. So two events that he goes well at, and obviously being Mexican, he's kind of in the area, so to speak. So it would have been nice to see how he gets on. I assume, you know, there's going to be no way he can start the rally unless they've got a spare car. So yeah, it's a bit of a shame, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Boys, I'm going to put you on the spot. Who's going to win Rally Mexico, Jack?
No, you're going to do it first, because you last time you did this, you said no one ever asked you, so you're going to go first this time. Who do you think is going to win Rally Mexico?
I was hoping you'd forgot. No. I am going to go with Walter Rull.
Ah.
Now, I'm going to go... And the reason why I've mentioned Walter Rull, I'm going to go possibly a little bit left field from all the obvious ones, and I'm going to go Andreas Mikkelsen.
Interesting.
That's where I'm going. Ryan Champion?
Well, a heart wants Chris Meek to pull one out, because it's about time he did, and that would be great to see, but I am going to go for Oit Tanak.
Okay. Interesting. Jack Bengen?
I'm going to go Chris Meek.
Okay.
I'm going to go Chris Meek.
I've made a note of all these, folks. I've made a note of all these. Right. Okay, a few bits of housekeeping before we move on to any other business. Jack Bengen, funny enough, I was speaking to Martin Wilkinson earlier. Frederick Arlen signs up for ERC.
Yes, Frederick's going to do Azores, and then after Azores, he's going to make a call on the next round, which is the tarmac round on the Rally Canarias. And then after that, he's doing Rome, Barum, Poland, and Latvia. So it's a bit of a warm-up for kind of going for the championship in 2019, if you like, and he'll stick in a Fabia, and Martin Morgeson's J1 will run him all this year.
Which is great. Ryan Champion, do you understand the logic behind what Frederick's doing? Obviously, done BRC for a couple of years, decided now to move away from it.
I guess if you wanted to step up from BRC, where'd you go? And your choice is obviously either WRC 2 or ERC. And there's no two ways about it. Doing WRC 2 properly is incredibly expensive. And not only that, you're up against effectively works, semi-works drivers, works teams that are in there as well. And I'm sure you get, you know, far more coverage for your sponsors in ERC probably than you do in WRC 2, because ultimately you're the top tier, aren't you? So, I can probably see why he's done it. But ERC, has that got the kudos it had a couple of years ago? Maybe not, but, you know, if he can go out there and show well in ERC, he maybe feels he can get better value and better coverage than he can in WRC too.
I think you've nailed it on the head there, right? Just to add, sorry, Tony, you have got to be in a manufacturer team if you're going to win WRC too. That's top and bottom of it is. You're not going to win WRC too unless you're in a manufacturer car. So if you've not got one of them, you're better off going to WRC.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting, obviously, what Ryze just said as well. Jack, you guys have done a bit of a piece on BRC as well. Obviously, Frederick's made his decision to move on from it. You know, Border Counties was cancelled last weekend, supposedly down to bad weather. I'm not sure. I'm sure weather was involved, but it wasn't the strongest entry. And it certainly wasn't the strongest entry for BRC. And I just wonder, when I looked at the entry list of that, and we had five R5 cars, have we gone through a cycle of people who can actually afford them now?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, you have got to look at the cost of the R5 formula for a national championship. You know, you're looking at £200,000 by the time you bought the car at least, and then you're looking at another 100-150 at least to run it for the year. You know, it's a difficult one. You know, you're talking, I don't want to start making racing comparisons, but basically, you know, you're spending a lot of money, and you know, a lot of these guys are just businessmen. They're not manufacturer backed or with huge sponsors or anything like that. So, yeah, I think there is a cost issue. I think it's a difficult one. Do you move away from R5 and move towards something else? It'd be a really ballsy move if you did. But I imagine they'll be considering it now. Although Ian Campbell did say to me that it had not crossed their mind that they hadn't thought of moving away from R5s. I think they'll have 8 when it comes to the second round on the Pirelli. So yeah, it's just going to have to be a wait and see sort of thing from the BRC, I think.
I had a conversation, Ryan, with somebody earlier today who's got an R5, and they've done a couple of events in it this year, and all the rose joints and all the bushes need to be replaced on it. Already it's done 200k's, and that's £2,800 just for the rose joints and the bushes.
Yeah, they're not cheap cars to run, and
therein lies the problem.
And also exactly what you're saying there, so in order to keep the build cost down, then it's fair to say lesser quality components are used, and then like you said, they wear out more quickly. If you try to replace the rose joints on a World Rally car, it costs significantly more, but then they last a lot longer. So, but you know, and even what Jack's saying there, I think, to be honest, I think if you had an R5 car sat ready to go, I certainly don't think 100,000 would get you anywhere near doing BRC. I don't think 150 would either, and that's the reality of it. They're an expensive car, and they're expensive to run. But as a formula worldwide, you'd have to say it's been a massive success. You know, we've seen M Sport, I don't know what they're up to now, does anyone know, 250 or more Fiestas. You know, and you're looking at how many Fabias are sold. We're going to see Volkswagen come in very soon. We've got Hyundai there now, etc. It is a very successful formula. We're just in the unfortunate position that rallying doesn't have a big profile in the UK, and it's very, very difficult to get budgets, to get sponsorship. It is a real shame because, yes, the cars are expensive to run, but they are... they are a good national championship car. It is a good level to be at in terms of performance, and they're good to drive. And, you know, and let's face it, where else do you go? What else do you have as the top line? We've tried that before. We tried going to R3 cars, to front-wheel drive cars, and, you know, it wasn't particularly exciting. It turned into a one-make championship, and people didn't want to watch it, at least with R5 cars. They're exciting enough for people to want to watch, and you have a good battle at the front. But, and if you look at Belgium, for example, then it works very, very well because they have good sponsorship in rallying. And I think it all comes back to the fact that rallying just isn't high enough profile in the UK to raise the sort of budget that an R5 car needs.
I'm genuinely really worried moving forward. I'm frightened for the fact that my thought process is that we've gone through the cycle of A, people who can afford them, and then the next tier to that is people who can afford them and then afford to run them properly. And the people who can afford to do that don't want to afford the time of a month out of their business, because 9 times out of 10 people are going to be working for themselves who do this, and it's a month out of your business to go and do the BRC. And I guess, do we need to start thinking about what the BRC is really meant to be trying to do and trying to achieve, Jack?
Yeah, definitely. It's really easy for us to sit here now and say, oh, it should do this, it should do that. But, you know, it is difficult. Like Ryan said, what do you go with instead of R5? What do you go back to two-wheel drive, or do you say it's only Evos, or you know, it's really difficult. And you have hit quite an important point there in terms of what is the BRC trying to achieve. I think there's people out there who want to do events that are longer than 45 miles. But, you know, if you've just described what you think is, you know, you kind of, your BRC person, which I don't think is wrong, is someone who has got enough money to kind of do the events, but doesn't want to spend a month away from their business. You know, they, you know, theoretically, that person, if you were looking at them on paper, they should go and do BTRDA, shouldn't they? That's a perfect championship for them. They can go and do it in a day, or, you know, maybe 2 days at the most, if you're going to go and scrutiny the night before. So you do need to kind of work out what the competitor doing.
Do you know what, Jack? Sorry to interrupt, my friend. No, right. This, it's almost got smatterings, and I forgive me because I know your knowledge of history of rallying and everything else, but to me at the moment, it's almost like, I'll bring to you first, Ryan, before I come back to Jack. It's like Ancro fulfilled back in the day. That kind of mileage, you could use world cars in it, and it was guys who had the money to go and do it, and it worked. And it's almost like that's where the BRC's heading, but it's almost wrestling with itself.
Well, it's been a balancing act for BRC over the last sort of 10 years or so, hasn't it? What does it want to be? And the aim of the BRC is still to be an aspirational championship, to try and develop young drivers, young talent that can then move up the ladder. That doesn't sit well with building a sustainable entry, because inherently you've only got so many young drivers that are aspirational that can get a budget together to do the championship. The only way the rallies can survive is to get entries, and then you end up with a national rally, and then you've got, as we've talked about this in the past, when you've got two or three rallies in one, it gets confusing for everybody. And then you've got the running order issue, where you've got national runners seeded in with BRC runners. And that's the issue. If you want to run an aspirational championship, you've only got so many aspirational people in it, and certainly aspirational people that can raise the budget. Or you run a championship that attracts competitors, that's sustainable, and obviously that's what we have with BTRDA. And unfortunately, what we're seeing in the UK is that there's not many people can afford to do a championship with longer rallies that allow recce's, allow pace notes. But they're all the things that you want and you need if you want to develop as a driver to move up further. And it would certainly be a sad day if we got to the situation in the UK where we didn't have any gravel rallies where you could go on recce, for example. You could go and make pace notes. And it really is very, very difficult to organise a BRC that is Like I said, going to develop drivers, is aspirational, but he's going to sustain enough entries to survive. And I think that's the issue we've seen for the last few years.
Jack, do you think it's because... Another reason is because the world's almost become a bit of a smaller place, hasn't it? You know, I don't say that flippantly, but you know, we've just been talking about Frederick going to do what he's doing. And all of a sudden, rallying abroad is a lot more cost effective and you get more bang for your buck. And a lot more people are looking at rallying in that particular sense and going, okay, well, I've got X amount of pounds. How many stage kilometers can I get for this? Well, if I go and do this, you know, people want me there. There may be, you know, subsidized entries, ferry deals, whatever it may be, to go and do Azores. And, you know, all of a sudden that's just as affordable as doing a BRC season.
Yeah, it's a tough one, that, because that in itself kind of goes against the thought process that people don't want to have time away from their business, doesn't it? Because you're going to take just as much time out of your business to do an ERC round as a BRC round.
I'm talking about, you know, you're talking about aspirational drivers, and of course we've got, we're using Frederick as a case in point, and of course Rhys Yates is also going to do the event as well. Mm-hmm. So they're drivers that we would definitely put in that aspirational kind of category.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're definitely, but, you know, you think of somebody, I don't know, maybe a businessman who, you know, it would be wrong of me to name people because, you know, they may still have aspirations or whatever. So I'm not going to name anybody. That would be unfair of me.
I get what you're saying. I think for me, the biggest problem is we've not got enough people coming into the sport at a lower level, because if you think about rallying as an upside down triangle where you've got the biggest part at the top, which is where most people should come in, and then you've got the smallest triangle at the bottom, which would be your WRC and your BRC and your ERC or whatever. So if the top of the triangle is getting smaller and smaller, there's less people coming into the sport, it's being squeezed more and more, less people are working their way down the triangles. So as you get to the bottom, instead of having, you know, 10 or 15 people who have worked their way up and have, you know, somehow managed to find the budget to keep going and have suddenly got to the sort of end goal, if you like, or they've made it to BRC level and that's their level and they're staying there, they're not good enough, or they've not got enough money to go further, then if less of those people are coming in at the top, less of the people are going to make it to the bottom. So you might argue that someone like Frederick Arlin or Rhys Yates, who, you know, well, Frederick definitely hasn't got the budget to go and do WRC2, you know, at top level, and that means he's not going to be able to go and do WRC at the top level. But would he stick around longer in the BRC if there was more people around, you know, competing at a higher level? My answer would probably be yes. So because you've not got those people coming in at the top, you're not getting as many people working their way down, and, you know, maybe four or five more people who would stick in the BRC. The numbers are crunched. It's tighter and tighter. Less people coming into the sport means less people at the bottom. That I think that's the best way I can describe it, and that's the only way I'd describe it, really.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's more to come from this, and as I say, I hope things do improve.
Just one other point on that, just while we're on, and you said, has the world become a smaller place? And I think it definitely has. Like 15 years ago, 20 years ago, for any driver looking at doing the British Championship, they wouldn't have dreamed of being able to do the WRC. But now, with the likes of the, what was Drive DMAC, Fiesta Trophy, or now JWRC again, your BRC budget is roughly the same probably as doing the Fiesta Championship in WRC. And if ultimately you want to be in WRC, well, why would you spend the money on an R5 car to do the British Championship if you can gain experience of WRC rounds? And like I said, when BRC was thriving, two things. Firstly, you had manufacturer money, but secondly, it was very, very difficult to be in WRC. Whereas now it's certainly not cheap, but it's more achievable probably than it used to be.
There you go. Let's just see
I know we've been on this for ages, but just one thing, because we talked a lot about Tom Williams over the last few weeks. Bang on exactly what a young driver should be doing in his situation. Instead of getting an R5 now, Tom, they've gone and done JWRC, so he's learning the rallies, getting experience of the recces, getting his notes, learning what the rallies are all about, and if he does want to make it to the WRC one day, that's the way to do it. Simple as that.
And you've stole my any other business, because on my any other business this week is Tom Williams, because he's out in Rally Mexico as well.
Sorry.
That's all right, it's fine. I know, but it's a very good case in point. It's a very good case in point. Boys, we're at the any other business section now, and I'll do mine, because, to be fair, Jack just set it up for me. My end of the business this week is our Brits that are doing in Rally Mexico at the lower the lower levels WRC 2, of course, Gus Greensmith, who was on the programme a few weeks back. Best of luck to Gus. Tom, again, a young man who we spoke to already, and we're trying to support as much as we can. Best of luck to those two guys. Bring it home, Royce. And any other business is get well soon to my co-driver, who very sadly had a big heart attack about 10 days ago. He's well and he's fine. And Ian Bevan, who is sat with a lot of people and he's done a lot of rallying all over the world, bless him. And he's had a lot of well wishes and everything else. But Ian, you'll be missed this season, my friend, and get well soon. So there you go. Right, Jack Benging, yours, please.
I've got two little bits. The first one being that I'm absolutely ecstatically excited, if that's even a word, that Walter Roll is going to drive his 1987 Pikes Peaks car at the Eifel Rally Festival in July, which is I don't know if I can say anything else. I'm just kind of looking at the picture.
I was going to go to that before, but I thought, no, one of the boys will do that. See how I left it alone, Jack?
So the car he won Pikes Peaks in 1987, he'll be demonstrating it July 19 to 21st. So that'll be really cool. And the other thing, just quickly, is Dave Evans has written a very, very good feature on Takamoto Katsuta, who won WRC2 in Sweden recently. It's a really good feature, and it's one of those that sort of exposes many, many things that you probably won't have known about Takamoto. Many things I definitely didn't know. One of them being that he was a very, very quick F3 driver in Japan, which obviously for someone who likes racing and rallying was very interesting. But yeah, brilliant feature from David, and definitely pick up MN and have a quick read of that, because it's got some really good background information, and I think he'll be one to watch in future as well.
Good man. Ryan Champion.
Well, a couple of things to cover. Firstly, for anybody who heard it earlier in the show, I'll apologise for the banging on the door. That was Terry Kirby clearly trying to break my hotel room door down. So I'll ask him what that was about in a little while. I should also wish my wife a happy birthday, as I'm in Sweden and Gemma is at home. So happy birthday, Gemma. And the other one, a little bit of a debate this one. Where does historic rallying go? We just talked about the future of BRC. Where does historic rallying go? In the UK, we've done something different to what the FIA have allowed. The FIA is now allowing cars from up to 1990. So we've now seen the likes of the Lancia Delta Integrale, the Mazda 323, Subaru Legacy, as the fastest cars in British rallying. That's been resisted by the RAC Championship in the UK so far, and that's why we've seen the likes of the Ford Escort stay as the front-running car. The likes of a Legacy, a pro-drive-built Legacy, you're going to be looking somewhere in the region of, I hate to think to build, actually, but well over £100,000, which I know an Escort is nowadays, but you certainly have significantly higher running costs with something like a Legacy or a Mazda with an X-Track gearbox. So a bit of a debate. I'd like to hear what our listeners think to this. Where does historic rallying go? You can't keep it at the same date forever. You've got to probably keep rolling forward and move it on, but inevitably, we get to more and more expensive cars. And a lot of these cars had very trick gearboxes in period that you simply can't get parts for anymore. So where do we go with it? What do you think, boys? Yeah,
I think it's got to adjust, surely. Go on, Jack.
I think the BTRD have opened a class to these cars that you're mentioning, Ryan.
But that's, the FIA have allowed them sort of 2 years earlier.
Yeah. I think if there was going to be a massive interest, then that should have come forward with the BTRD Championship. Whether that's just kind of slipped through the cracks a little bit and people don't really know that the BTRD are doing this class, I'm not really sure. But I can see why the British Historic Championship has made the decision it's made, because, it's dominated by about 15 Escorts. So if they suddenly turn around and say, all these four-wheel drive cars can come in, then it's going to wipe out half their customer base, aren't they? So from a business point of view, I can see where the decision's come from. From a rallying sort of perspective moving forward, I think there needs to be a sort of a bit of a movement sort of gathering pace with people with these cars to come together and say, we do want to compete in this championship, and there is a market for us. Because at the minute, I can completely understand why British Historic Championship have done what they've done, because they're protecting their current customers. So I think the BTRD class is there, and if that grows in the next couple of years and we do start to see some of these Legacies and Deltas and some of the Mazdas as well, then that would be fantastic for national rallying, for you know, to go out into a forest and see a, you know, a Delta doing a British gravel rally would be phenomenal.
Not to forget the Mitsubishi Galant that I recently tested as well. That was a cool car.
Yeah. Tom Kofsky. Yeah.
Definitely. Tom Kofsky. Yeah, I think, I can understand the decision of the British Historic Championship, but maybe if there's a bit of pace gathered behind this movement, then, you know, they can be persuaded and that can change.
There you go, boys. Before we go, Gary Boyd has supplied us with facts. I know I've been doing them at the top of the programme, but because we started with Britney Spears, we'll finish with Gary Boyd. It's obvious, really, isn't it, when you say it out loud? That's the way you would always start a programme. Right, Gary Boyd's facts for this week, and yeah, this may stimulate a little bit more debate, but please, not this week, if it's all right, boys. A different twist on the 13-6 for Seb Loeb and Daniel Elena. A mind-blowing fact. From July 2005, Argentina, to April 2012, Argentina, Seb Loeb and Daniel Elena were unbeaten on Latin American soil. They won all 13 WRC rounds held in Central and South America over the 6 years and 9 month period. Boom.
Ow.
Boom.
We're not allowed to answer, Jack, so we just have to leave it there. Drop the mic.
Do you know what? Right, you can say something, but keep it brief.
No, I'm not going to say anything.
Okay, fine.
I'm good.
I don't think he'll continue that run.
There you go. That was the shortest amount of words.
Well done, Ryan.
Yeah, well done. Boys, are we all back together next week?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Yeah, Jack didn't seem certain there, but that's good. Folks, you know where to find us. It is @Absolute_RallyCross on Twitter, facebook.com/AbsoluteRally, Absolute Rally rather, and absoluterally.co.uk for the previous episodes if you want to seek those out as well. Folks, we are going to go to a little break. Me and the boys will be back same time, same place next week, but we're going to cross over to Martin Holmes now.
You're listening to Absolute Rally. Get all the latest updates by following us on Twitter @Absolute_Rally.
Welcome back to Absolute Rally. It's always an honour and always a pleasure to have a friend of the show and esteemed, I don't even know what your full title is, Martin Holmes, but former co-driver, photographer, journalist,
author.
There's so many. So anyway, welcome back to Absolute Rally, Martin Holmes. Good to speak.
Great.
We always kind of, when we set these things up, have some kind of order that we'd like to go through. And I like this theory before we go any further, that there was just one note that I made and it was out of control, which is very apt, really, I suppose, for rallying. But I suppose it runs a little bit deeper than just in the car. Just give us your thoughts of what we've just been talking about there with regards to being out of control.
Different things. Things get done without any policy, without any obvious pattern to what is going on. This is, of course, international levels as well as national levels. Briefly talking about the national levels, we have the new open roads, the stages, public road stages, which I've not had anybody come out with a policy saying, this is what we want to achieve. We've got this new rally that's going to be over in East Anglia, but for the life of me, I can't see what it's trying to achieve. We've had the Jim Clark rally in Scotland, which we came to know all about, and obviously for different reasons, there's been a problem there. But then, when we're talking about the nature of British roads, we are faced immediately with the speed issue. And the speed issue then leads us to worries about average speeds and how to contain them, whether chicanes are the answer and everything like that. Nobody comes up with a policy. Now, I don't follow Formula One as much as I would like to, but that's only a question of available time. But you have Ross Brawn going around in Formula One, having a chance to explain to people, hey, don't think about that. Go in that direction. Steer clear of that. We don't have anybody in the sport in that way. And then we've had quite a number of things recently which are really strange, clearly showing that there's no policy, no direction going on in the sport. And that's what I worry about at the moment.
Do you feel, just obviously we're becoming, as ever, we always do a little bit of UK centricity, as it were. Do you feel, obviously, with David Richards now being at the head of the MSA, that we will get that direction? You know, somebody, you know, from a rally background who's kind of seen it from every angle. Do you think that moving forward will be the solution?
Well, I don't know what sort of effect David would have on the British Federation. I hope that ideas that he has, if they are obviously ideas that we like, will be useful and will have a chance to be implemented. But quite often you do get people coming to an establishment like the British Federation, any other federations, and all of a sudden he finds you up against a brick wall. I don't know whether that is the case here. I hope it won't be, but I don't know. I don't know anything more.
Now, I guess from that as well, you know, you've mentioned other things, I suppose, in British. You know, I've got a really, really big concern for British rallying at the moment. You know, we've spoke about obviously stages, and we've talked about stage quality, and we talk about obviously the roads being opened up and all the things that come with that. But also, you know, there is definitely a massive imbalance now. There is incredible amounts of money being spent to me in British rallying at the moment. You only have to look around at you know, a service park on most rallies, and you know, there's money being spent, but there's so much of a disconnect that's going on at the moment, and I don't know what it is. You know, you've just used Formula One as an example of something else there, and I'm going to use it again here. You know, is Formula One, is it so far away from club sport, and, you know, club racing and things like that? Have we got to that point now in rallying where rallying is so far away from the higher echelons of it? It's almost like it runs autonomously. It's almost like a completely different sport.
Well, obviously, things change and develop all the time. Obviously, what is interesting is the amount of money which is available. But then that's all through life, all through the present situation, how things are in 2018. Whether that's bad or good or bad, I don't know. I mean, what it does mean is that the world is changing, and it's a question of adjusting what happens in the world to suit the latest circumstance. When we talk about David Richards, clearly we look to the future, and he has the opportunity to bring experiences to bear, and I just hope it works.
Me too. Me too. Now, one of the other things that we mentioned as well when we've been speaking is with regards to regulations, and obviously that you could almost tie this in what we've been talking about being out of control to a point of, you know, there's no, I suppose, homologated rallying seems to be disappearing now, and I'm kind of conflicted on this, where I think, great, let's get as many cars out there as possible. Let's bring back, you know, people have been talking quite a lot recently about, you know, Andy Burton's car, which is very famous over here in the UK. And there's a couple of other cars around the world, you know, bringing these cars back because they got people talking and they got people excited. But, you know, manufacturers are not homologating cars either anymore. And that's, to me, that's another problem. Because it skews class systems massively, you know, everywhere, really. I don't know. I don't quite know where I'm going with this, to be honest, but there's something not quite right.
One of the problems that we have is the way that road legislation changes. And certainly I do know that one of the basic theories behind Group R, the series of formerly called Group R, is adjusting to street legislation. When you had the old Group A, B, N system, you had situations which were beginning to frighten manufacturers. They were marketing parts which could well be said to have been illegal on the roads in different countries. Not that they deliberately did it, but it's just the way that the legislation itself was changing all the time. Now, I think that is one of the stories behind this. Another story is, of course, the way that the regulations are written, that it isn't possible to make cheap cars. And if you start allowing cheap cars to run, then you have huge safety implications and everything like that. Now, for you and I, we might say, well, let's just say that's part of the risk of the game. But for a federation, they've got to take a position on this, and clearly they can't just allow carte blanche as we used to have in the past.
Do you think it is, you know, the way the regulations are, do you think we are now creating this diversity in splitting the sport up? Obviously, we've seen what's gone on, you know, over the other side of the world with likes of AP4 and AP4 Plus. Are we now kind of taking things upon ourselves now to because, you know, I take on board what you're saying there about Group R, but, you know, we're in the realms now of there's so many national championships that don't run to those regulations, and cars get kind of bowled into those regulations that, there's just, we are kind of lacking this cohesion again, aren't we?
Some of the strangest things are happening all over the world. One of the things which I haven't yet seen many of the magazines talking about is this extraordinary business we are now seeing with the Group S. Sometimes it's called the ability to use nationally accepted cars and things like that. What was it, 1 or 2 weeks ago was the first round of the African FIA Regional Championship. It was the Bandama in Ivory Coast. Second and third placed vehicles on that were, what do you call them?
Quad bikes.
Yeah, or you might be S by S, or those types of vehicles. Now, did we ever have a sport for that? and of course, who's actually noticing these things? That's another thing. And who actually sees this as a direction that we shouldn't be going in, or that we should be going in? I just don't know.
Do you think anybody outside of the immediate, and this is, I guess, the other thing, isn't it? You know, we're all guilty of it in many aspects of life, really, where we're okay, we're getting on. You don't really look at what your neighbours are doing, or the neighbour 4 doors down, or whatever it may be. Is this something that the FIA needs to be looking at as the world governing body of kind of getting things back in some kind of line?
The FIA can obviously see falling entries with orthodox cars and are permitting these changes simply for the purpose of keeping more people being able to do major events in their countries.
Yeah, I guess, but I suppose when we go down that route, I made reference to it before, you know, I'm sure you remember it. You think about somebody like Andy Burton's car, which had this massive kind of cult following in the UK. It sounded phenomenal. It looked phenomenal when it was in a forest, but we're not allowed it anymore in this country.
No, I can't give you an answer to that. I don't know whether that's good or bad. But I mean, all I can say is from a federation point of view, it's a worry.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to get your take on, even though it seems like it's ages ago now, I do want to just get your take. We're not going to talk about Sweden. I want to talk about what Seb did. I want your interpretation of it.
Oh, I think it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, I don't know whose brilliant idea it was, but I mean, hats off, that was terrific.
It had the smatterings of a co-driver. And I'm not saying it was Julien. I'm just thinking about, I look at, you know, M Sports management and the people who are around, you know, Ian Turley and John Millington and people like that, you know, proper, you know, old school co-drivers, road rallies and, you know, events who pride themselves in finding these types of things, I think.
Looking at that general situation, we have another thing. The FIA is being driven by different people all the time, being driven by Jean Todt, the president, being driven by the commissions, is being driven by the promoters, and never the train, or whatever, the three of them can be called, agree with each other. And I think this is leading to chaos, and we're having the way that the promoters perceive the television public will want to have a podium there and then. And all of a sudden, this whole business of Ogier doing what he did in Sweden throws all the chaos into the plans of the promoter. Now, what is the rally for? Is it sport? Is it for television? Is it for the gratification of the promoter? I mean, we really don't know. And then, obviously, while we're speaking about that, is the whole question of the Safari Rally and where Jean Todt stands in this question of, is the Safari Rally type of event, does it have any future in the World Championship? Years and years ago, I used to plead with the Safari organizers, saying, look, give up the whole thought of the World Championship, because the World Championship is not for this type of event. But this new rally raid activity is bang on what the Safari Rally should be all about. And, of course, they said, ah, don't be silly. The World Championship is the greatest championship. Anyway, Jean Todt has been saying some things recently to give encouragement to various people in Kenya that they should, in fact, try to go back into the World Championship again. And this is another, this is where we came in, that's a curious development which I find difficult to understand. Now, one of the things, well, I think probably what Jean Todt, when he eventually moves on from being the president of the FIA, will be remembered for is not running the sport. It is for his road safety campaigns. I mean, I think this is marvelous. Now, we have in Kenya one of the most dangerous road situations in the world. Africa alone is something like 10 times more likely to kill the people on the roads than Europe. And this is something which obviously Jean Todt, through the FIA, has noticed, and is not for reasons, not for stupid reasons. Why does he make colleagues, his friends in different federations, aware of the opportunities of doing something about it? It isn't, well, certainly at this time, simply a way to get votes to keep him in power or anything like that. I think Todt has now been able to move on from that. But I have a feeling that this whole road safety campaign of Jean Todt has got a lot of sense and a lot of purpose behind it. Now, why he should encourage or give accept the intention of the people in that country to go back into the World Championship, I don't know. And, of course, the very thought of being able to have the World Championship, including Safari again, excites fans and leads to a lot of unfortunate directions in which people are thinking. I think it should never be encouraged. There are plenty of other things. There's plenty of rally raids now which would accept the Safari style, and that would be really good.
Do you not think, you know, it's unfortunately, Ryan's been away for the last few weeks, of course, the man who won the last one along with somebody else, but hey, that was the complications behind the Safari Rally, but we haven't had a chance to speak to Ryan about it yet. Obviously, you know, he knows what they go through on those events, you know what they go through. I just can't imagine, and I know I just can't imagine seeing a 20, you know, we'll still call it a 2017 World Car. I just can't imagine seeing one of those in Safari spec anyway. We all know what TTE went through back in the day. You know, they basically based themselves out there for best part of a year, you know, to get a car ready for it. I just don't see that happening. I just, I don't know. It almost feels like a gimmick. Almost in trying to pay lip service and, you know, to give maybe the fans looking through rosy coloured spectacles a little bit of hope that there could be this historic famous event coming back into the World Rally Championship.
I think you're completely right, and I think it's very unfortunate.
Yeah. But there you go. There you go. I'm sure.
There are other things going on these days.
Yeah.
Which I think emphasise the fact that things seem to be out of control. Mexico this week. Ceremonial start takes place after the first stage. Isn't that weird?
Very.
Do people say, hey, what's going on? No, they just don't notice.
I'm sure I've done a rally like that somewhere, and for the life of me, I can't remember where it was. But anyway, that's a different point for a different day. But again, we're back in the realms of what's the championship, what's the promoter, what are we trying to achieve? And, you know, at least they've admitted, I think, was it last year where they had the cars transported all the way down to the street stage and then sent all the way back?
Well, ironically, the thing which caused the cancellations on the Friday stages in Mexico last year was not actually the fact of having to transport. It was a misfortune with the road being blocked for many hours, holding up all the transporters.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, in fact, the decision to start in Mexico. It was something which happened as a result of that, not because of it.
Mm. With regards to the event, obviously, we see Loeb coming back. I don't think we ever really got to the bottom of what your thoughts were on this. You know, we spoke to Craig Breen last week, and, you know, Craig obviously had a fantastic result on Sweden, you know, probably the strongest, you know, Citroën driver this season so far, with only two events gone, of course. But he's the man who's missing out. Obviously, Loeb is coming back. It's a commercial decision. I think if you don't see that, then I'd be very surprised, you know, as a listener as well. What are your thoughts with regards to Loeb coming back on Mexico events, which, of course, he's won six times?
It's what Citroën Racing are trying to achieve. If they enter the World Championship and treat what they do in such a cavalier fashion, I think it throws a mockery on the championship as much as anything else. It's not that I'm against Sebastian, but I mean, he was quoted recently as saying, well, it was just a matter of process of elimination which rallies I would be able to do. Oh, I've got the Rallycross Championship. Of course, that ties me up quite a lot. Then, of course, another rally. Oh, I can't go to Germany because I'm on holiday that weekend. I mean, crumbs, what's going on?
Yeah.
I just wish somebody like a Ross Brawn would go to Citroën and say, get your act together.
It seems odd now because we keep on hearing and people keep on expressing the opinion that, you know, it's now run a lot more commercially, obviously, excuse me, and that's why the cuts have been made and everything else. And you look, obviously, you know, back in the heyday of the Zara and things like that, that wasn't run commercially, but clearly it worked, and the commercial success kind of came because of, not in spite of, what they were doing.
Well, there's many different reasons. It's a lot to do with the effect of promotion. I mean, we know that the WRC is not well effectively promoted compared with things like Formula One. And then we have highly energetic PR people in Rallycross telling us how that this is the sport of them all.
Just before you carry on, can I just ask you something about that? I've read a lot of press releases this week with regards to Will Rallycross, and I always find it quite interesting how they always make reference to rally cars, and they're like big rally cars. You know, it's like rally cars, but better. And it's almost like you don't need to say that anymore. Surely you stand on your own two feet, you know. And this is the other thing, I suppose, with having, you know, Petter there and having Sebastian there and, you know, various other people that have kind of come and gone from, you know, from a rallying background and stuff like that. Surely now it stands on its own two feet and we don't have to keep, it doesn't have to keep making reference to rallying.
Doesn't even have to be called rallycross. I mean, all it is rough road circuit racing.
Yeah.
And I just wish that people wouldn't use the term rally in rallycross. I think it's just unfortunate.
Yeah, I've said that many times. Can I just ask you, before I let you carry on, sorry, we're just talking about the Loeb effect and what Citroën is trying to do and things like, do you feel if Sebastien Ogier would have went back to Citroën, Loeb would have been coming back and doing these splattering of events that he chose to do?
I've no idea.
Do you think the reason why I say that is that obviously, you know, we know they're a French team and everything else, and you just wonder whether, okay, it just so happens that in their stable they have a 9-time World Rally Champion who happens to be French. And from, you know, from a PR point of view, obviously they got a Frenchman behind the wheel on some of these events. If they would have had Ogier for the season, probably wouldn't have been required.
Well, also, of course, it makes you wonder what is the commercial value of having two drivers from Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of where I was going with that, to be honest with you. But so Rally Mexico, does Mr. Loeb, bearing in mind road position and everything else, does he have a hope?
Well, he's got the road hope. There is the starting position advantage on this event, but he hasn't been in a world championship rally for 3 years. He hasn't been in Mexico for 6 years. I don't think so.
No. But it's, you know, it is a nice story. And there's part of me that I suppose the fan part of me wants.
It's not actually a nice story. Well, I think it's a story about Breen.
Well, no, listen, and Craig, I class Craig as a friend, and absolutely. And I've kind of tried to put that to
one. It's a story about management messing around at Citroën.
Yeah.
It's not, to my mind, a nice story.
Well, let me qualify that statement. I putting Craig to one side, because I do class him as a friend. Yeah, I am gutted for him. Of course I'm gutted for him for not being in the car. But where I was going to go with this, you know, the rally fan that's in me and the young rally fan that I remember, you know, Loeb in the Super 1600 and stuff like that, I am really interested to see what happens when he comes back. And I don't know whether it's going to be like the Schumacher effect when he came back to F1. I really don't know. But I just want to see what happens. Really want
to
see.
Well, I mean, we have these things. We've had a series of these things in Finland. You know, in Finland, there's been this wonderful little habit of old-time drivers coming back to the Neste Rally, the Thousand Lakes Rally, in their 51st, when they're 51 years old. And this year, Grönholm is 50, and he's going to be an opportunity in 2019 to have the chance himself to do the Neste Rally when he's 51, just like other drivers have done in the past. That, I think, is a nice situation. But obviously, it's not going to show anything more than seeing an old friend back in action again.
Obviously, we've got the runners and riders, you know, who are there. You know, a fantastic performance from the Hyundais on Rally Sweden. We've still got concerns with regards to, are they a little bit fragile? Are they not a little bit fragile? The common consensus is they've still got this thing to be a little bit fragile. But do we see Thierry really, really, you know, making a mark this season?
Are we talking about car fragility or driver fragility?
Oh, good point. Good point. I like that. I like that, Martin. Let's go car first.
Oh, I think there's nothing much wrong with the Hyundai.
Okay.
It's going in the right direction. I think that's good.
Now let's go driver then.
Well, I mean, Thierry is the one person. I mean, one day it has to come good for him, but it's just just a little bit, not quite yet.
Geez, he is a very confident young man. He has had his confidence knocked, of course, last year. You know, we all know the statistics of things would have been a little bit different on those events where there was, you know, some errors made and things like that. But if and buts and pots and pans, we'd all be scrap metal merchants at the end of the day. But out of all the rest of the pack, other than Oit Tanak, I don't see anybody else challenging Ogier.
I don't know. It's too early to say. This is far too early to say things. After this rally, things start getting to normal. I mean, we've had the first two rallies, which don't prove anything in the general scheme of things, not in a season-long scheme of things. This there's a question to ask before Argentina, I think, or even better still, after Argentina.
I will always agree with you to a point, but the point I'm making about Tanak is Tanak has hit the ground running in that car.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is not only in his own team, where probably Yari Matti's kind of looking, going, oh no, not again. With regards to having a very dominant teammate, but I think that's made such a statement. And I know it's very early in the season and everything else, but you could almost accept that Tanak was going to play himself in. If he's still playing himself in, Martin, he's going to be there or thereabouts.
Well, I don't think he's thinking of playing himself in. I think he's thinking he's going to be the best anyway. And it's just a question to find out if his hopes are misplaced or not.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, before you go, I'm gonna put you on the spot. And I'm going to ask you for your three on Mexico this weekend.
Oh, I'm bad at this. Well, it's easier to discount people rather than...
Well, we can do reverse process.
I don't think that Loeb is going to be the one to shake the champagne. I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that let's go through. Ogier is always going to be there. Evans... There's some occasions where he's really comes good, but not often. But it'd be nice if he does. Sunen hasn't even had any testing for this rally. Mickelson isn't quite stable yet. Neuville is becoming more stable. Sordo is a good person to go for a podium. Latvala is... the great driver, the only drivers had done this rally, I think, 12 times before, or 11 times before. This is his 12th effort.
Wow.
Whereas some people like Lappi haven't even been there before. Tanak is really looking to the future and hoping that his future is going to come good. Chris Meek, well, of course, he did win last year. He was the person that took advantage of starting or running order. And guess what? He's going to have a good starting order position this year. Sebastian is what we said. So I haven't really given you an answer, have I?
No. If some may say you've sat on the fence, Martin, but no, not I. I would never say that.
What you can say is an open day. It's an open story. It's an open opportunity for a lot of different people.
Absolutely, absolutely. Listen, Martin, as ever, I always love chewing the fat with you. Are you back with us again next season?
Pardon?
Are you going to be back with us on our second season for the year in a few weeks' time?
Yeah, I hope so.
Oh, that's all right then. That's all right then. Martin Hopes,
yes,
thank
you. Oh, sorry, with you, yes.
Yeah, with us, of course. You, yeah. Yeah, that's all right then. Martin, thank you so much for joining us this week on Absolute Rally. We'll be back after this break, folks.
You're listening to Absolute Rally. Get all the latest updates by following us on Twitter @Absolute_Rally.
Welcome back to the final section of Absolute Rally, and obviously the feature we've been running for the, well, for the season really is the bits and pieces we've been doing with Trev and coaching and things like that. And we're on our next section, which is section four, which is of course, well, I want to say of course, as if you know, you don't. I didn't know until 30 seconds ago because I had to check with Trev. It's limiting beliefs.
It's section three as well.
Yeah. So it's limiting beliefs, and I wanted to, obviously we're doing it kind of to go via, I suppose, the way the website runs as well, because obviously your website stage by stage obviously takes people through this as well, doesn't it, Trev?
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. Me putting together stage by stage was on the back of the first rally I did for WRC Live, and we were talking about some of the things about confidence for drivers, and I got a few comments back, and people have always said you should put something down, you should write something. So I thought as a resource for people to tap into, I'll just take up a simple WordPress blog, which is what I did way back then. I'm guilty of not updating it as regularly as I thought I would at the start, but it's the usual thing when it comes to things like that. But yeah, if you go on stagebystage.com, click on blog, and start at the bottom, work your way up. It'll roughly follow what we're talking about. It gives you a reference on what coaching is versus mentoring, and then the sequences around setting goals and where you are and what options you have and what you're going to do eventually. So with this series, Tony, we started off and we asked the question, why do you rally? Just to really get people fundamentally thinking about why they go rally and what's the big benefit to them. Second part of it on the back of that then was, what is the long-term goal? And we certainly referenced, you know, if you want to be serious about it and go professional and get to a world championship level, then the goal ideally be 5 years, but let's look at 10 years. The next stage of that then, for those people who are lacking a little bit of confidence, maybe a bit of lack of self-belief, a bit like when you drive out to the first stage of a rally, Tony, you have those little doubts and those nerves kicking in. It's the same thing when you start to get people to plan where they're going to go with it. And sometimes that lack of confidence will hold them back and actually planning the goal that is achievable. So my job in life now is to help people maximize their potential. So to perform at the highest level, you've got to sometimes just investigate these beliefs that you have.
Does everybody have those doubts then? I thought it was just me.
Everybody that I've met in my life, you'd be surprised the number of people who ask me about it, Tony. You know, even today I'm coaching some people through an assessment that they're going to have in a little while, and we're doing some practice simulations around that. And it's amazing people who do things day by day, and you put them in a strange environment or just ramp up the pressure a little bit and it all creeps in. And we see it in sport, don't we, all the time. If you look at professional football players or in the Paralympics and the Olympics and the Winter Olympics that we just saw, just that little bit of doubt. And there's a great book called, a series of books. The first one was called The Inner Game of Tennis, written by a guy called Timothy Galway. Timothy Galway, incidentally, went on to train Sir John Whitmore, who sadly passed away last year. He was an ex-touring car champion, and his book's called Coaching for Performance, get these words out. That's effectively the coaching Bible, so it all links in quite nicely. But Timothy Galway's big statement was, the biggest competitor is the one inside your head. So in our case, it's not the person who's running a minute or 2 minutes behind you. It's not the road that you're driving on. It's trying to still your mind and get rid of that self-doubt. So that's the limiting beliefs is a way of doing that and investigating that.
It's interesting because it's weird parallels, of course, in my life of some of the other things that I've done. But I met a very, very famous comedian who I was working with once, and when I very first started, and he turned around to me and said, you will never find a constipated comedian. And I think rallying is quite similar to that, or it certainly is for me anyway.
It's the same for everybody. And you know, what is it that creeps in that stops you believing that you can do something when you've proven that you can? You know, you make your way up the ladder, you make your way progress through from a beginner to getting to winning your class championship in your club, to maybe a regional one. And all the time, as you move up, you think, oh, maybe people are expecting too much of me. And that nagging doubt will always come in. But we can work on that.
It is, as you say, you know, and I've talked to, you know, young drivers and stuff like that, even in my time. And, you know, it's very, very easy. I find it easy to talk to people and give them, you know, some of the pep talks and things like that, a lot easier than it is for me to actually accept them, let alone from myself. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's easier to actually, you know, because you do it a lot. You talk to drivers, and obviously you were very successful anyway. So it's a slightly conflicting question for you for this move. But I find it easier to talk to drivers and probably better drivers than me that I've talked to that I've bumped into in service, and we've went and had a cup of coffee and we've had a chat, and then they've gone out and, you know, they've had a fantastic afternoon. They've rang me afterwards and went, really helped having that chat. What do you think it is? What do you think the difference is?
It's just something that's hardwired into us, Tony, and it's one of the techniques that I use actually. So if somebody is having an issue like that, exactly as you described it, a simple question to ask somebody is, you know, if that was your best friend, what would you tell them?
Yeah.
You know, and it clarifies it, because it's not you. It gets rid of some of that self-doubt. But the main focus is really what you're thinking about. Is it true or is it an assumption? And trying to get that reality, trying to make sure it's absolutely true, as opposed to what you think or, you know, something that's holding you back or a belief. But if you look at the facts a lot of the time for those people who have those self-doubts and you just read the facts back to them, sometimes that's enough just to get them over it, you know. The facts about the performance that they've had, the reason that they were picked for a particular team or they're using a particular car, whatever it may be, is all down to how good they've been, you know. And again, it's the same techniques that I've been using this week. You know, got people in a job and they wouldn't be in that job unless they were good at it. And all we're doing now is trying to tweak what they do to absolutely maximise the performance. So getting from good to great. And go on.
Sorry, I was just going to say, so does limiting beliefs also work the other way? Or is that counterproductive? And what I mean is by that, is there a situation where you can limit your beliefs by actually having a realisation that you're not going to go and take 30 seconds out of Sebastian Ogier, for example?
I think everything needs to be based on reality.
Yeah.
If you wanted to be Sebastian Ogier and you wanted to do it in a year or 2 years, then you're just a bit silly at the end of the day, aren't you? There's no doubt you need to have confidence, and that's the key. We've seen it time after time. Every rally we go to, you'll hear the comment at the end of the stage, somebody's lacking confidence. And what does that actually mean? It means that they can't find the rhythm. And that's either down to how the car feels to them on a particular day, or maybe they haven't dialed it in correctly. But that lack of confidence sometimes is a mental barrier. It's simply, yeah, you can imagine a situation where you go to a rally and you've crashed in the previous rally, and you're approaching the same stage, the same corner. And if you're in that mode where as soon as the car steps out, it gets a little bit out of control, you start thinking about, oh, here we go again. And you don't have time, if you're that quick and you're that good at that level, to think in those terms. You have to react first. And the reason that you're not reacting is because you're nervous, you're a little bit tense, you're holding the steering wheel a little bit tighter, and that disrupts the flow. And when you disrupt the flow, you lose that whole automated way that you drive. And when you do that, then you're thinking too much about it, and that's what it's all about. And it's very hard for people just to calm their mind. You know, if you said to them, well, just relax, you can't do that. So what you have to do instead is a couple of techniques where you can fill your mind full of the really useful feedback that you need in order to drive the car really competitively. So just mentioned there, if your hands are tight on the steering wheel, it's simple. What you do in that situation is just from a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being how tight they are holding the steering wheel, what are they? As soon as you actually do use that scale, and this is no different to somebody out for a jog, if their calf muscle cramps up a little bit, if you put a scale on it between 1 and 10, the next time you do it, literally 2 seconds later, you'll notice that you're a lot more relaxed. And we actually, when Slipstream, we started our sports management company way back in 2000, we got a hypnotherapist in, Tony. And we actually sat, Neil Weirden and I sat together, and we went through the perfect stage, talked it through, and we started to recreate situations under pressure. And these are the techniques that we were using way back then, and they're still applicable today. They're used in every other sport. Motorsport doesn't really take those on, and it's the most bizarre thing over the years. I can't fathom why motorsport doesn't use other sports techniques and the resources that are available to help in the biggest competitor, help with the biggest competitor, which is the one inside your head.
Do you think it's rallying specifically that still struggles with it? Or do you think other forms? Because, you know, in my head, I think other forms of motorsport seem to be almost a step ahead of the game than rallying when it comes to this type of stuff. I may be wrong, and by all means put me straight. And if anybody listening, by all means put me straight. But, you know, I can't remember, and it'd be unfair of me to quote directly, but I wonder if it was you that said it, Trev, or it was somebody else with regards to Tommy Mäkinen, where he felt he would be pace-wise on Monte Carlo, say this year, for example, obviously having been very successful on it, and Sweden, places like that. And he said, you know, when those, you know, when I was where these lads are now, I was away skiing, I wasn't in the gym. You know, we've moved on again.
Yeah.
You know, are we slowly but surely, is the ship turning? You know, but are we still quite antiquated almost when it comes to, you know, the mental workout that we need to give ourselves?
Yeah, they've upped their game as regards physical fitness and as regards that. But apart from that, there's not much else goes on, Tony. There's not much else goes on to help with the biggest, as I say, the biggest competitors, the one inside their head. So how can they work on the mental side of things? And if you ask any driver, and I've done this at world level, if you ask them, what percentage do you think is mental? What percentage is the physical attributes, the skills and knowledge that you've had over the years? A lot of them will say probably 60% mental, or, you know, that's a conservative. And then if you ask the question, what are you doing to train that side of it? Can you train your mind? Of course you can. You can learn techniques that will help you with that. But that seems to be, maybe it's a macho thing, maybe. That's what I've always thought anyway in motorsport.
It's interesting. I was going to go next. That's where I was going to go. I was going to go to ego next. Mm. That was going to be my next point, you know.
It's not just what we're talking about, Tony. It's people who are moving up through the ranks, to get them to go and have somebody help them set up their car. There's a professional driver who's been that and an expert in that particular category of car they're in. It's very difficult sometimes to get them to do that because it is this macho thing. And in motorsport, certainly when you get to the highest level, asking, you know, imagine one of the drivers at world level, European level, wherever, and their theory, at least the common belief used to be, I haven't questioned it much lately, but the common belief used to be, if you can teach me to drive, you're a better driver than me, and that's impossible because I'm the quickest.
Yeah.
If you applied that to any other sport, if people think you're mad. Why would Roger Federer have a tennis coach in that case?
Well, do you know what? I'm not just agreeing with you because I've had this conversation for probably the last 10 years, and I've used a football analogy. And, you know, without doubt, as much as it pains me to say it because of where I'm from, the most successful, you know, football manager over the last kind of 20, 25 years was Sir Alex Ferguson. He wasn't a great footballer.
No.
He wasn't that successful as a footballer. He had a career. It wasn't amazing. But he managed to mold and produce several teams to be mega, mega successful. That doesn't happen by accident. So why is it that somebody has to be better than you at the particular thing to coach you? I find that really interesting.
But they don't. I could coach anybody in any sport because the whole ethos of coaching is getting people to work it out for themselves. You mentioned Alex Ferguson. He never took any of the coaching sessions. He left it to his coaches. Yeah. He watched them. He observed them. He probably gave feedback on them, but he certainly didn't need them.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, again, and you know, that's the thing, you know, why does, you know, and I'm sure I can't even name the top golfer now, to be honest with you, but I always remember, you know, Tiger Woods had a swing coach.
Yeah.
And you can do your own jokes at this point, because obviously that now has a double meaning for Tiger Woods. But, you know, he had a swing coach. Why would he have a swing coach? He was the best in the world by a long shot at the time. But yet, like you've just used, you know, Roger Federer and people like that, they still have people who could, I suppose, it's like having a pair of eyes. It's like having an out-of-body experience. And what I mean is by that, it's having somebody looking at you from the outside, almost with your own eyes, because you trust them so much to give you that calculated feedback.
It's not complicated. What we'll do is we'll get Molly Taylor on, and Molly's agreed to come on and just talk about the work that we've done over the last sort of 9 years or so. And I'd probably say, if you ask Molly what we do, couldn't tell you. And that's what proper coaching is all about. We have a chat in the back of that. She often does something, and Molly's that good. She'll come back and say, right, I've done that. What else can I do? But all the time, I'm just questioning her. And don't get me wrong, coaching isn't soft. Like, I certainly challenge people when I'm coaching them, just to get rid of all the rubbish that's going on in their head and, you know, these assumptions and what people make. So I'm quite harsh when it comes to making assumptions. Is it fact or is it true? So that's really what we're talking about. We're mentioning limiting beliefs is how I've worded it in the blog. And once you get your head around that, and once you realise that you can get help with it, then it's a massive step forward. But it's just, you know, this usual thing. That's why the people who I coach, Molly's always been quite open. That's why I've mentioned her. She's always happy to help other people. That's her nature. And she'll come on, we'll have a chat with her, or you can have a chat with her, me being on. She's available this week, I think. And that'll be something we'll slot into the podcast next week.
Yeah, you know, we'll definitely get, obviously, Molly's been on before anyway, so it'll be good to get Molly on. So what's the hanging question, Trev, we're going to leave this week for our listeners?
The hanging question is, if you're limiting what you can do, in other words, if you're trying to put together a long-term goal, which is why we're linking it into last week, make sure that you don't limit it based on an assumption or based on what others have done. So we talk about budget all the time, for example. If your budget next year is £50,000 and you've only ever raised £5,000 and you think it's impossible for me to raise £50,000, impossible based on what?
Yeah.
So is it fact or is it you make an assumption?
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's leave that one hanging, folks. We've had some great feedback from this, by the way. And Trev's getting stuff to send direct to him. We're getting sent stuff to the studio. If you want to send us the studio address, it's studio@absoluterally.co.uk. And let's keep this one bubbling away. Trev, you're back with us next week. For next week's section is obviously we're up to part 5 next week, which is knowledge, skills and attitude needed to achieve your goals.
You've jumped the gun a little bit there. I think we're going to go, where are you now? So the reality and performance or whatever. We're doing 3 today. Next week will be 4. But you give away what we're doing on week apologies. 5 now.
I know. Well, do you know what? Mexico's quite busy. Obviously, after next week, we've got a few things coming up. We're going to try and get Molly on. We're going to go after Rally Mexico, of course, and do a review of what happened there. But certainly in the quieter weeks, we may well jump ahead, or we may even do 2 sections in a week, just because people are loving it so much as well. So
you said, Tony, thanks very much for all the feedback. It inspires us to do more, I suppose.
I guess it does. Folks, that's it for this week. It has been an epic podcast. Thank you to Martin Holmes. Thank you to Jack Benging. Thank you to Ryan's Champion. Thank you to Trevor Agnew. And thank you to you, the listener, because without you, we'd just be a load of the blokes just talking about rallying. Some may say talking bollocks. There you go. I'm allowed to say that. It's my podcast. But we do really, really appreciate the download. Folks, keep spreading the love. Keep spreading the word. You know how to find us. It's @absolute_rally on Twitter. It's facebook.com/absoluterally. If you can take the time and the trouble to leave us some feedback on iTunes, I keep talking about it. It will really, really make a difference. And as I say, keep telling your rally friends all about us. Folks, we'll be back same time, same place, in your little podcast hole next week.